episode of Drug Target Review's podcast. I'm your co-host, Taylor, editor of Drug Target Review, and today I'm joined with Ellen.
Thanks, Taylor. I'm Ellen, the editorial assistant for Drug Target Review, and it's great to be co-hosting with you today. In this episode, we'll be discussing CRISPR-Cas and its impact on gene editing.
Bringing their expertise today, I'm thrilled to introduce Dr. Pietro D'Angeli, scientist at Tübingen University Hospital, and Dr. Martin Gertz, postdoctoral fellow at the Princess Máxima Center for Pediatric Oncology. It'd be fantastic to hear a bit more about your backgrounds, so I'll pass over to you, Pietro.
Thank you very much. I'm Pietro D'Angeli, and thank you very much for the invitation. I work at the Institute for Ophthalmic Research of the University Hospital Tübingen in Germany, where I pretty much focus on the development of gene editing strategies for treating inherited retinal disorders.
Brilliant. Thanks, Pietro. Passing over to you, Martin.
First of all, thank you for the invitation. My name is Martin Gertz, and I've worked for the past 8 years on CRISPR-Cas9 technologies. I did an internship in the lab of George Church and David Liu at Harvard, where I learned a lot about these technologies. Then I did my PhD in the lab of Hans Clevers, where I applied all of those technologies in organoids to really create relevant disease models. And now I'm in the Princess Máxima Center trying to scale up CRISPR technology. So we're moving more into the CRISPR screening direction, basically.
So, to kick off today's conversation, what comparative safety profiles exist between utilising plasmid DNA, mRNA, and ribonucleoproteins, RNPs, as delivery systems for CRISPR-Cas components in gene editing therapies?
Generally speaking, much of the safety profile of gene editors also depends on the type of cells being targeted, whether the approach is ex vivo or in vivo, and how the DNA, mRNA, or RNPs are delivered. So when we focus into in vivo applications, these editing molecules are rarely delivered in their naked form. So they are typically encapsulated into, let's call it, a delivery formulation that could take the form of virus particles, lipoparticles, or nanoparticles. These are common delivery vehicles, let's say. So in the whole, the delivery formulation impacts also on the safety profile. However, the situation changes slightly when we talk about ex vivo gene editing strategies, where more often the editing molecules are delivered naked, mainly through electroporation. So in this case, comparably, RNPs are the safest options as they are already active editing reagents. They act quickly and their turnover is quick inside the cells. So basically, after 24 hours, the cells are cleared of the editing reagents. And usually they do not elicit any immune response, which can be, of course, detrimental for cells. Conversely, delivery of editing reagents through DNA or mRNA is a bit more problematic when it comes to immune response, for example, again, focusing on ex vivo editing approaches, because they can trigger immune response. And this is mostly due to the fact that you have specific pathways of our innate immune system that can recognize them, and also because the expression of these reagents is longer, so they can elicit more immune response.
Yeah, I agree with basically everything that Pietro is saying. And I think one more thing that is important to realize here as well is that even though it is not happening that often, if you would put DNA, being it plasmid or just double-stranded piece of DNA, into cells, there's always a very small possibility that this DNA will actually be incorporated into the genome. This is not really the case with mRNA and definitely not for protein, but basically this is an extra risk that we have if we would put DNA into cells. Luckily, if we would actually do ex vivo strategies, normally you would, for instance, electroporate your cells with your DNA, grow a clone, and then we could do extensive testing on this clone to see if we actually have any of these negative side effects. But this is something that we actually do have to take into account.
Thanks for sharing both. Moving on from that, how do RNPs and CRISPR-Cas-based gene editing demonstrate improved specificity in comparison to other delivery methods? Starting with Martin.
Yeah, so it is important to basically realize here that all the different strategies, so either DNA, mRNA, or protein, they all have a different length of time that these will be basically available in the nucleus. So Pietro already talked about this in the previous question, where he said that RNPs will only be in the nucleus for roughly 24 hours, whereas for mRNA or for DNA, this can be up to up to a week even, we do see some of the Cas9 expression in our cells. Then if you think about how Cas9 itself works, basically what it will do, it will start scanning the genome for its target site. And basically, if you give it a very long time to look for target sites, the opportunities for it finding an off-target site are also increased. So basically, the most safe way of doing gene editing is by giving a very short pulse of your Cas9 to then only basically give it the time to find its true target site where we actually wanted to target to. And then if you, for instance, have this for a week in your cell, you will just keep accumulating off-target effects as well.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I think I don't have much to add to what Martin's just said. The only point I could contribute to is that when you are using RMPs, again, for ex vivo mostly, you have better chance also to tune the concentration of your reagents, which then relate to what we have said in terms of off-target events or aberrations.
Yeah, exactly. I fully agree with that. Because like what we see in our tests as well is that if we pump some DNA into our cells, the transfection efficiency will be very low. But the cells that do actually get transfected often have a very high copy number of this DNA. So it's very difficult to basically tune the expression by DNA, whereas indeed what you're saying, Pietro, with RMPs, it will be way more easier to actually tune this accordingly and thereby result in very low off-target efficiency or effects in this case.
Thank you both. So adding to that, how do RNPs mitigate concerns related to the persistence of foreign genetic material, reducing the potential for unintended consequences in edited cells?
RMPs is the active editing reagent, let's call it that way. So as soon as it enters the cells and the nucleus, it's active, so it can do the job immediately. Whereas when we are dealing with DNA and mRNAs, these molecules have to go through first transcription and then translation for the DNA, whereas for the mRNA, the active protein RMP has to be first translated from the mRNA. So this brings to delay. And apart from this, what we also mentioned already is that the expression of the editing molecules coming from DNA and RNA persists for weeks. And if the DNA even integrates into the cells, then at that point can also be for months. And there is also another aspect that I wanted to mention in terms of persistence of foreign genetic material into the cells, is that what we observe or what we should also consider is that when we use DNA and mRNA to, DNA actually, to transfect the cells are shifting paths or of their sources towards the transcription and translations of this transgene, the way we call it technically. Meaning that what we observe could be a metabolic load that has perturbation effects at the level of transcriptomes and proteasomes. And in some instances, we don't really care about this, but in some more specific applications, this could be a problem. This is very well known coming from the protein engineering field, where bacteria are used to generate recombinant proteins. So a transgene is put into bacteria to produce a recombinant protein and has the name of the metabolic loads. However, in the field on genome editing and genome engineering is still something that we are not really following up, but I believe it's also a crucial point when it comes to persistence of foreign genetic material into the cells.
I fully agree with this. Indeed, like it's all about the timing of your Cas9. And as long as we can keep it in there as short as possible, I think that's always going to be our safest bet. And indeed, what we were seeing, so in my PhD work, I did a lot of work in organoids. So we always had to transfect adult stem cells, basically, and keep them in a stem cell state. It was actually quite difficult if you deliver a lot of DNA in there, basically, and if you completely rewire their transcription towards creating Cas9 components. So we saw some issues there with actually keeping them undifferentiated.
Thank you, Martin. So following on, what advancements in RMP technology contribute to their increased viability as a safe and efficient tool for gene editing? I'll start with Martin.
Yeah, so I think the coolest things that are happening right now are really on the delivery part. So I think we know quite well how we can create these RMPs. And I think most labs that work with CRISPR can create their own RMPs as well. But what most interests me is that the big labs that were really at the forefront of developing CRISPR technologies are now shifting their field more towards delivery to also in the future, of course, bring this into the clinics. So there's a few interesting things that have been happening over the past few years. So one is from the lab of David Liu, where they created these engineered viral lipid particles. And they can basically, what they do is they have a Cas9 protein, or in their case, often they use base editors or prime editors. And they have a cleaved sequence to the capsid of the viral capsid. And basically in this way, they can create a viral particle that can readily deliver their RMP into a wide variety of cells. And they can even point this towards only a specific organ, so that even if you would have unintended editing, it would only be, for instance, in the liver. And another approach that I think is really cool is that what was Jennifer Doudna's lab, what she did, I think last year, she published this in Molecular Therapy, where what she did is she basically loaded the Cas9 protein with NLSs on the C and the N terminus. And she showed that if you inject these NLS-loaded Cas9s into the brains of mice, that they would just readily go into the cells. So it is more on the delivery part of the RMPs where we see the huge, how do you say that, developments now, I think, which is also the most important thing if we actually want to bring it into the clinic.
Yeah, I fully agree with Martens. What I think is crucial at the moment is to find ways to scale these alternative delivery methods towards clinics. Because at the moment, the gold standard, let's say, is viral-based, which is not optimal when it comes to performing editing, because again, it's longer term compared to what we need. So it's not a hit-and-go situation. So the biggest hurdle at the moment is to find ways to scale these non-viral delivery methods to clinical applications. And this probably will be requiring some more times. But at the preclinical level, it's really promising.
Thank you both. So Pietro, you mentioned scalability. In what ways might the use of different ex vivo applications affect the scalability and feasibility of large-scale gene editing treatments?
Yeah, so this is really an interesting question. So by now we have established that for ex vivo applications, the delivery of RMPs through electroporation is the standard practice. So it's a well-established platform, safe and also powerful in terms of mediating editing. And in this case, what we have basically is that Cas9 is a two-element system. So we have the endonuclease, which is the protein part, and then we have the RNA. So in terms of scalability, what we can think of is that the endonuclease, so the protein part, is constant, and this can be produced in large batches, also at clinical grade, without much cost, I would say. And then on the other side, we have the RNA, that is the part that is specifying for the target, and this has to be designed specifically for every therapeutic indications or approach. And in this case, the guide RNA will have to be the risk. So we'll have to show that the guide RNA is powerful and safe. So by having this modular system, what we can do is simply to scale up the production and application of editing strategies for larger gene editing treatments. So at the moment, what I see as a problem is not the technology itself, but rather the legal framework. Because, of course, what you have is huge burdens in terms of preclinical data that you need for accessing to an IND application in order to be able to treat patients. And of course, this means that companies are focusing on more common disorders, right? Because they are looking for commercial viable opportunities. Meaning that if you are, I don't know if we can call it luck enough to end up in the part of the patients having a common disorders, then of course you have the chance also in the next years to have the possibility to access gene editing treatments. One example is the recently approved Casgevy, which is an ex vivo editing applications to treat specific hemoglobinopathies, for example. However, if you have a rare conditions that is caused by a mutation that you even know how you can treat, and you can also implement the platform that we have just described in a really easy and straightforward way, of course, the chance of getting, let's say, cured is much lower. And this also brings in some moral obligations of university, academic institutions, and so on. But I will stop it here for the moment.
I fully agree with what you're saying. And I think with this, it would be great if also for like the newer variants of these more interesting Cas9, so base and prime editors or Cas9s that can come from different bacterial species. I think all will have a place in the clinics in the future. Yeah. And it would be great if indeed we could just show the safety of the effector molecule, so the Cas9 itself, and then maybe ex vivo show, look, we do not see any off-target effects, like in a combination with the guide RNA. But if indeed for like every disease, we have to go through the whole process of actually showing that the whole complex is safe, I think we will never be able to truly use the power of this gene editing tool for all the rare diseases as well.
If I can add to that, I think it's a really interesting point. There are initiatives right now that are basically led and sponsored by outstanding names like Jennifer Doudna, for example, that are opening up dialogues with FDA to try to find a way in between in terms of burdens for providing preclinical data. And if you think about the ex vivo editing of cells, when you stuff or you deliver the cells with the editors, being RMPs, for example, the final product is not the editing itself, but is the edited cells. So what they are pushing towards is to ask FDA basically to treat the editing machinery and the editing process as a reagent and not as a drug. And this would, of course, enable faster preclinical development. But it's just a proposal so far. Let's see.
Yeah, that's cool. I was also involved in some discussions by the EMA on how we can actually increase in the, like what we're talking about right now, like how can we make it easier to actually bring these technologies into the clinics? And this was exactly the point that was mentioned there. And I think it is very important that, well, of course, Jennifer Doudna is the winner of the Nobel Prize in 2019. It's great that she's on the forefront of this as well, because we need these big names to basically push for the whole field to incorporate this technology more broadly across disease.
Thank you both. How might the convergence of CRISPR-Cas technology with artificial intelligence and machine learning improve precision medicine?
So about machine learning and AI, I think the possibilities here are limitless, basically, because AI and machine learning have or are enabling the pooling of super huge data sets and big data to find patterns there that could be useful for drug development, for example, in our case. And in the case of the CRISPR-Cas9 technology, what I find that could be really a game changer is the ability to pull together or complement data coming from off-target screenings with on-target screenings and potency screenings of guide RNAs or different base editors together with data coming from the 3D structure of the protein, for example, and guide RNA structure and so on and so forth, with the aim to generate a machine learning algorithm or tool that is able basically to, upon a query, for example, you want to target a specific gene, is able to give you the guide RNA sequence, but not just that, but also all the modifications at the protein level that might be required to achieve that level of specificity that is, for example, required in clinics. So this would be basically a game changer that is also a bit scary if you think about that, because then one wouldn't need any more experimental work to be done. But I think this could be really a powerful tool to set up in the future, if possible.
So what I think with AI is indeed what you were saying is that we can really design the best guide RNAs and the safest guide RNAs in combination with the best protein. Then also there's a few other things that I think we can do with AI, and that's already been done, and that is more on the more evolved variants of Cas9. So for instance, for prime editing, this is this technology where we have a Cas9 that is fused to a reverse transcriptase. And then as a guide RNA, we have an elongated guide RNA that has the repair template for the guide RNA incorporated into the guide. But while this works very well, it is still very difficult to actually design such a guide RNA combination. So there have been a few efforts out there that use machine learning and AI to actually design the best guide RNA combinations for prime editing. And that really makes implementation of that technology also a lot easier. So to give that a little bit of more numbers, before the AI tools, you needed to screen up to, like 96 or 384 different guide RNA combinations. And now you only need to screen 8 or 10 guide RNA combinations to get to a very efficient prime editing experiment. And this will really make it easier to develop prime editing-based gene therapies in the future, I think.
So in what ways could CRISPR-Cas-based gene editing techniques facilitate the development of more accurate disease models? Pietro, if we start with you.
Basically, the development of precise disease models takes huge benefit from the use of CRISPR-Cas9 editing systems, because if we think of personalized medicine, targeting a specific mutation, for example, through CRISPR-Cas9, we can use it as a tool for treatment, but we can also use it for editing cells so that we can introduce the specific variant or disease-causing variant into the genome of iPSCs, for example, and then to use them, the edited iPSC clones or cell cultures, to differentiate them in disease-relevant 3D cellular models, for example, where then we can test our gene editing strategies, for example, because, of course, if we are targeting a specific mutation or gene or a sequence, more generally, we need to have the genetic context in the cells that we are using for developing the therapeutic tools.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I think the thing that's important to add here is that, again, for the problem that we have without Cas9 is that if we want to study a specific mutation, what we could normally do is we can isolate some cells from a patient that has this mutation and then isolate some cells from a wild type, so non-affected person. However, the downside here is that basically besides this one mutation, there will be many, many differences across the genome. So even though we're all much alike, there still will have 200 or 300,000 point mutations that might still affect or have an effect beyond the mutation that's actually causing the disease. So the nice thing that we can do is that we can actually create isogenic cell lines or cell models or 3D models, whatever we can put our Cas9 components in. And then basically there is no additional effect of anywhere else in the genome or any other mutation that is maybe in the genome. And this will basically result in that we need less disease models. So we don't need very high numbers of different patients to collaborate in a study or to donate material in their study to actually study the mutation that they have. But we can just create all of these isogenic lines in the lab and then thereby study the precise effect of that mutation on the cell.
And something we are also facing is that when you are studying rare variants, for example, and you rely on patient materials, it's really difficult to find homozygous cases. So depending on what you study, the counter allele might have an effect on the readout or phenotype. So what you, Martin, just said is really important.
Great, thank you. And finally, how might the continued advancement of CRISPR-Cas gene editing reshape our therapeutic approach? And what implications could this hold for the treatment of previously incurable diseases?
So with Cas9 technology and with these newer variants like base and prime editors, we can really start to edit individual point mutations and really start to repair them now ex vivo and maybe in the future in vivo. So indeed, there's all these rare incurable diseases that we could not target previously, and they have a genetic cause. So with these technologies, I believe that in the future, even in the near future, we can start to really, instead of like giving a therapy, we can just fix the mutation altogether. But I think there's also another part that's really important here, because a big proportion of the patients that cannot really be cured in this way is the people that have cancer. And often we give them very high doses of chemotherapeutics. And what we could do already right now is we can start doing screens on, for instance, genome-wide or on certain subsets of genes, and then do those screens together with the chemotherapeutics that we're now giving to our patients. And what we can see is that maybe there's combinations of genes that will pop up that might result in very good therapy efficiencies. So in this way, we can find, for instance, better ways of treating the patients that we have right now with the treatments that are already approved by the FDA or by the EMA, for instance. So by doing these more fundamental things, we can already start curing the current patients that we have better.
What I could contribute to is that for sure we will be, and we are already able to CRISPR patients and people, let's say. However, what we also have to consider is the framework around in terms of infrastructure needed, for example, trained people needed to administer the CRISPR therapeutics, for example, and so on and so forth. And this bottleneck kind of issue just also came evident now with the first approved, FDA approved, but also EMA approved, worldwide approved, I would say by now, I guess, Casgevy, CRISPR therapeutics for sickle cell, where, for example, there are some big universities in the US, like Alabama, that at the moment they can only think of treating, for example, 12 patients because of lack of infrastructures for and facilities. So it's a more complex issue to be addressed if we think of large-scale CRISPRing kind of people.
Thanks, Pietro. And that's a wrap for this chat today. A huge thanks, Pietro and Martin, for joining us and for diving into such a fascinating conversation. It's been an honor talking with you both.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning into this Drug Target Review podcast, sponsored by Molecular Devices. I've been Taylor Mixtes, editor of Drug Target Review, and we really hope you enjoyed this episode.
And I've been Ellen, editorial assistant of Drug Target Review.